The following episode of Fathermore Podcast is with Carl Pauli as my guest. And Carl has a really powerful emotional story around his becoming a father and being a father. In fact, Carl is not even 40 years old, and he has an 8-month-old grandson. And his grandson is just the joy of his life. He really talks about him in really interesting ways. And I think a big part of that is because he and his wife adopted their daughter when she was a teenager. So they fostered her for about 1.5 years and then adopted her while she was a teenager. So they didn't really experience the newborn thing. They went straight into being adoptive parents for a teenager. And then now they have this grandson in their life. It's really this very emotionally charged, powerful, intimate, honest conversation. And I greatly enjoyed getting to know Carl better, getting to hear his story, getting to hear him talk through just the challenges and the chaos and the pain and rebuilding himself and his family around the structure that was just something that was foreign to him because they didn't have any kids. And now they have not just a daughter, but also a grandson. And it's really, really interesting to just see and hear him tell this story about, you know, the past 7 or 8 years of their life and experiencing becoming parents to a teenager and then years and years later, then becoming the experiencing having a newborn around and having a baby around. It really is powerful stuff. And I hope you guys enjoy the conversation because I know that I did. Take care.
I think a good place to start is, how old are you, Carl?
I'm 39, turning 40 in April.
April what?
April 13th.
Hey, man, I'm April 14. What's up?
Almost tax day. Bam.
That's right. That's right. I always tell people, you know,
it used to be fun.
Yeah. a couple auspicious dates. It's like April 14th is the day before tax day. It's the day Lincoln was shot. It's the day the Titanic sank.
Whoa.
Lots of really interesting things going on my birthday. Our birthdays have some auspicious events surrounding them.
Wow. I was the eve of all those things. So right before.
Yeah.
Interesting.
The reason why I'm asking how old you are is because I think you have a really interesting, and I'm not even 100% clear on exactly how your entire like fatherhood journey has unfolded, which I'm really excited to get into, which is why I didn't ask beforehand, because I want to talk to you about it like fresh, you know?
Great.
But you have a really interesting like parenting journey, right? And I guess to start with the most recent thing is you have a grandson. You have a 9-month-old grandson.
Just turned 8 months.
Yeah. So that's a young, beautiful, healthy baby. Post all these wonderful photos with them on Instagram. You guys look like you're having a great time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I guess, explain a little bit, like, right, give me a little bit of background here. How are you at 39 the grandfather for an 8-month-old?
Yeah, I don't know how did this happen. Yeah, I was actually telling my mom the other day, I was like, how did I get here? This is crazy. But it's the best ever. I guess the short story is Tanya and I, we became foster parents in 2014. And our then foster daughter, Tanai, just moved in with us and she was 16. And 1.5 years later, we officially adopted her, officially becoming our daughter. That led to now her being 23 and being a mother. And in becoming a mother last February, we became grandparents.
Congratulations on all fronts.
Yeah, here we are. It's been a crazy, 7 years, 8 years?
That's wild. That's really amazing. Like, there's a lot there. You know, I think there's a lot there that I've gotten a chance to talk to a lot of dads so far. I love it. It's been awesome. And each one has had a very unique and different sort of way that they became a dad, and the sort of different types of experiences they've had. And I think you're probably the most unique of them all, because you're the first one that has an adoptive daughter that entered your life as a teenager. And you're also the first one with a grandchild who's less than a year old. And I think those are all really interesting things. I'm curious, how did you and Tanya come out to, you know, come around to becoming foster parents? Like, how did that even occur?
Well, it was not my choice. I'll tell you that. I never really wanted to. I never had the urge or inkling of wanting to be a parent. I just thought, oh, I'll live like this my whole life, and if I happen to have kids, well, yeah, that's great. But I wasn't planning on it, nor did I ever have the conversation of trying, until one day I noticed that this girl started taking classes with Tanya, gymnastics classes, and Tanya was coaching her in gymnastics. She was part of this girls' team. And they started to bond in the gym. I just noticed that they were always talking to each other. They did a lot of one-on-ones and just spent a lot of time with each other. And I spent my years traveling. I was out of the house, you know, 200 plus days a year. And every weekend I was gone teaching seminars. And when I was gone, Tanya and Tanai would get together outside of the gym, and they would meet up, and she would come over to our place, and they would have lunch, and they started to bond. And one day I was on a plane on my way back home, and Tanya sent me a picture of Tanai sitting at our kitchen table having lunch. And she just had this like big smile on her face. And I had only seen her, talked to her briefly at the gym, but never really interacted with her. And in that moment, I just got this feeling. I was like, whoa, what is this? And I got kind of emotional. And I just felt like this is something special. And I came home. Tanai had already gone back to her place. And it was just Tanya and myself. And Tanya's like, yeah, it's been a great weekend. We hung out, and I really love this girl. It's so great to be in her life. And I was like, oh, that's amazing. I would love to get to know her sometime. So a couple of weeks went by, and we started to get together. We hung out. And one day we went to do a little road trip, and we went to the Monterey Bay Aquarium, and we went to the aquarium and spent time there, and I got to know her. And that day I also felt this like deep connection. And Tanya started to not only mentor her and spend time with her, but also advocate for her. So she would go to these monthly meetings at the group home where she was living at the time. And on one of these meetings, they were trying to place her somewhere. And Tanya felt like, they're going to place her somewhere outside of this group home. And I'm unsure where she's going to go. And I don't know if that's the best option for her. So Tanya asked the group home, what would it look like to become a foster parent? And they immediately pulled her in and said, this is what you do. And then Tanya came to me and said, hey, I am looking at the paperwork for becoming a foster parent. And I was like, what?
What? Like, we just went to the aquarium a second ago.
Exactly. And everything was just moving so fast in my life at the time that I was just allowing myself to go along for the ride. And before you know it, we were hanging out with her on her birthday, her 16th birthday, and we were supposed to catch a plane to go to Sweden. And we went to the airport after hanging out with her, and Tanya's passport was expired. So all of a sudden, we bought ourselves another 24 hours to be in San Francisco and hang out with her. So we went back to finish the day with her and got to hang out for her birthday. And that's when we asked her if she would be willing to move in with us. And she said, yes. And we said, well, we'll be back on August 13th. We're going to talk to the group home. We're going to finalize the paperwork. And if you're still keen to do this, we'll come and pick you up straight off the plane when we land. So on August 13th of 2014, we got off the plane at 1:30. At 2:30, we were at the group home. We got her bags, and at 3:30, we were in the car, and she moved in with us. And that's how it happened. And then as she was living with us, we were doing all the prerequisites. It moved so fast, but we had to take classes and go through background checks and all kinds of things. But everything was just unfolding. And then all of a sudden, we were a family unit.
That's amazing. What an interesting story, because usually, usually the I brought my daughter home story doesn't involve, you know, I landed an hour later, I picked up my new foster daughter and brought them home. And the language that you're using to describe it, it sounds and feels the same language that I would hear of, you know, new parents for a newborn, that they're bringing their kid home from the hospital. And I think that's really interesting. Where did you think that turn happened for you when you went from not really thinking about or wanting, to have kids to, you know, just the light switch being switched of being, not only is this okay, but it sounds like something that you like proactively were interested in creating for yourself and your family.
Yeah, that happened. Tanai got permission to do an overnight with us, and we had dinner at home. And after dinner, she said, I'm going to go to bed. Tanya went into the room with her and kind of put her to bed. And I was just sitting there on the couch, and Tanya came out and sat next to me, and we were just sitting there, no TV, no nothing. We were just sitting there. We're like, oh, what's happening? There's a person sleeping in that room right now. And here we are. And she looked at me, Tanya looked at me, I looked at her, and she said, we could do this. And I said, we could. It just felt really good in that moment. And this was, you know, completely blind, but we just felt like this was it. This was right. So that's when the turn happened. And then the rest is kind of history. It just unfolded from there, because I was now emotionally invested.
What was it like becoming a father to a teenager without having raised a kid from like 0 to 14?
Insane.
I was actually kind of hoping you'd say that, because if you were like, you know, it was great, it was easy, it was nice, everything flowed really well, that would have been a really boring podcast.
Well, the first week was amazing. It was like, wow, this is just so perfect. We are just the perfect family unit. And then slowly but surely, everything started to come out. Not only the teenage stages, but also all the trauma that we knew from just reading on paper, but now we're getting to experience firsthand. And getting into details, it was very, very challenging, because we had no skills, no resources to manage this. And there were a lot of very small things that were happening that were so hard to grasp what they really meant, that we just felt very helpless. And, they give you all these numbers like child crisis, and you get access to all the different services in case something happens. And it was very scary because nobody had any answers. Absolutely nobody. And it was pure chaos for probably 3 to 6 months, every single day. And you can look up what used to be called RAD, which is reactive attachment disorder. It's not a thing anymore, but if you look it up and you just look up the symptoms or what it looks like expressively, 19 out of 20 things were manifesting in our household. And it was just absolute chaos. And we were in utter despair. We had no clue how we were going to navigate this. And we weren't even married, and we were planning on getting married that year. We canceled our wedding, postponed it for a year. I was separating from a business partner, and all of a sudden, in financial distress, everything was just crumbling. So it was a nightmare of a period of time there, and learning to step into the role of becoming a father was really challenging for many reasons. One, I had only known her for a few months. Two, I was one of her fathers, one of her dads. She had another biological dad out there somewhere, which she hadn't connected with in many years, but we did manage to reconnect them. And unfortunately, 2 weeks after them reconnecting, he passed away. And then that led to now unraveling what it meant for her to have a biological father who will always be her father figure. And now myself coming into the picture. And then you couple in race and her being Black and us being white, that also added in another layer that I was completely unaware of. Back then, I was naive, believing that color wasn't a thing, and that, oh yeah, this is how we do it these days. And it wasn't true. It's not how we do it these days. We are just learning what this even means. So yeah, it was a very turbulent, challenging time. Dark.
There's so much. There's so much there. You know, that first week being high on the endorphins of having a child, having a baby, that's also a thing. Like, that's exactly what I think a lot of new dads go through. And I'm just kind of blown away by how, you know, the broad strokes, obviously the details aren't the same, but the broad strokes are very similar. This like euphoria that you have, that like you have this new member of your family, that your unit has grown, your pack has grown a little bit, and how everything feels like it's just cloud nine. Everything's rolling perfectly. There aren't any hiccups, no speed bumps or anything. And then it kind of starts unraveling. You know, like my son's almost 3 months. And he's doing great, knock on wood. He's very healthy. My wife is very healthy, but there's like a controlled chaos in our lives. Like I was telling you right before we started recording, like I'm not even in California right now. My wife and I are in Washington State visiting her parents and her family. And, you know, we brought the baby. It's been a week. He hasn't had like a normal schedule, but we've been trying to keep it like regulated as best we can. Yeah. And like, you just kind of roll with like this ocean of chaos as best you can with him at the center of it, just trying to keep him like, you know, grounded and with some sort of regularity. So, you know, he goes with the flow very well, but that idea of just living within the eye of the storm for so long, I think is relatable for a lot of new dads. And
yeah,
it seems like it's a little bit more of like an extreme situation, but because, you know, the way you described it was very when it rains it pours, right? Because you're just getting to know this person who has a personality, a history, She has her own experiences that she's bringing to the table, experiences that you might have maybe a very cursory understanding of, but not really an intimate understanding of. And at the same time, you're going through professional issues. And at the same time, you're, you know, kind of taking away from the cup that is like your relationship with your wife. And so there's a lot that I feel like is worth diving into there. And I think probably the best place to start would be, how did you navigate keeping yourself, you know, Carl Pauly, sane? And like, you know, how did you water that plant and keep yourself like sane and balanced throughout all of those different changes?
I didn't.
Yes.
I just didn't. I had so much anxiety. I cried very often. But what I learned to love was family therapy. I'm like, yes, family therapy is Tuesday. Let's go. This is the best. Let's make this happen. So family therapy was very, very helpful, at least for me. Nobody liked it but me. But it really was grounding for me. So that was one thing. The other thing was, I was already going down a very introspective path. So the moments of silence that existed in between the noise were times where I had these big revelations of, oh, what does it mean to be a human walking on this planet? Who am I in relationship to this person? Who am I in relationship to my wife now? What is this family unit? Where is it unfolding? Should I even think about that? And thankfully, I was still traveling. So when I was overseas or on a weekend trip, that gave me a lot of separation and perspective. And what used to drain me in traveling now was my chance to recoup. So that was when I was trying to restore. And I was always gearing up for the re-entry into the household. And every time, every day, I mean, it's kind of like with a baby, every day is slightly new. It's just like, oh, look, he just made this little face. He just moved his hand in this way. Oh, he's grabbing me like this. Oh, I realize that if I soothe him in this way, he feels a little better. Oh, if we bathe him and then we bottle, it works better. Or bottle and then whatever. You know, you start to just learn these small little things. And once we got to a place where we at least had a baseline of what to expect from a basic behavior, there I was able to plant my feet and say, okay, this is my role. And as long as I continue to come back to this, I can do some self-care. But it was not easy. It was something I did not think I was going to survive, because that was for the first time in my life. I really thought I understand why people want to end their lives. And the pain that exists in the world is so ginormous that it's unbearable to carry if you lean into it, or so I thought. So yeah, it was challenging, but somehow with family and friends and a lot of patience and just these moments of clarity that came from all of a sudden, you know, Tanai having a moment, my daughter having a moment where, let's say, she took a bath and then she came out of the bathroom and said, hey, I wrote a poem. And we're like, you wrote a poem? Read it for us. And then she's like, oh, I can't read it in front of you guys. I'm too shy. Okay, we'll go in the kitchen and you read it from the living room and we'll just listen from there. And then her having the guts to share this poem, and then us hearing this poem and just being like, waterworks, because it was so insightful, and just realizing, wow, this woman, this young woman is amazing, and we are so lucky to get to witness her unfolding, regardless of how messy. And in the messiness, the chaos, there was one thing that hit me, which is that I realized that chaos is self-organizing. And when you realize this, that chaos is self-organizing, you can position yourself wherever chaos takes you in a way where you can be of service to chaos. You can hold space for chaos. You can direct chaos. And although there's a part of you there that feels like you're just being reflexive, reactive, when you choose to position yourself wherever the chaos sends you, you actually become deliberate, responsive. And there you find your power. You find, again, this sense of, I have control over a few things. And those few things, although they are a small rudder on this massive ship in this massive storm, I can influence it. And thus, I'm going to at least try.
So that I was actually going to ask you how you found your role, right? Because so much of this sounds like, you know, carving out a space where, you know, generally speaking, you know, we, like, you know, a lot of men, a lot of fathers, especially early on in being a dad, feel kind of alienated or isolated, maybe a little bit useless in a way. That's maybe a strong term, but we're not necessarily the prime caregiver. Like, we're not the prime thing, connection that our new child has, right? And a lot of what that first 3, 6 months, 9 months, whatever, I don't know when the light of the tunnel is, but a lot of it feels like trying to just carve out, like, as hard as I can, a role that gives me the opportunity to be helpful, a positive impact, you know, either supportive to, mostly to my wife, honestly, that she's doing so much of the work. And I was going to ask you how you were able to sort of carve that out, but you brought this idea of, like, you know, chaos as sort of self-organizing force and being able to find the little things that you can control and using those as just turn the ship as slowly as you need to, but you're turning the ship nonetheless. Have you found that this almost, like, it sounds like an epiphany, so I'm going to describe it as an epiphany, but this, like, epiphany about chaos since then has been able to sort of, like, help you? Or were you like, you know what, I have this ability now, but it needs this type of, like, extreme insanity around me for it to be really useful? Or are you able to actually apply that in your day-to-day life now?
Yeah, that applies to my day-to-day life, because my life has felt like utter chaos since August 13th of 2014. And not because of our daughter coming into our lives. It had already started. The storm started in December of 2013. So it has nothing to do with that. It just has been a decade, basically, of madness. But I had to go through the madness to arrive at a place where I am today. I think it's slightly different. I had a slightly different experience, I think, than most fathers have, especially if they have a baby that comes into their lives, which is that we didn't have a baby. We had a teenager. And Tanai, as a teenager, she hadn't been around a lot of men. And so I was a very different figure in her life, especially when it came from a perspective of a man who nurtures. So something that she used to do in the beginning was she would, like, touch my face and my hands and my feet. And she was, like, very, she wanted to cuddle up to me a lot. And at first I was like, wait a second, you're almost a grown woman, and I don't know if this is appropriate. Like, with a baby, you're snuggling, you kiss him, and you do all these things. But with a teenager, how do you do that? Anyways, this is something that came up in therapy, and said, no. Our therapist explained, she's just exploring you. This is, she may look like a 16-year-old, but inside, this is a child exploring something completely new. And that led to a place where every day we would sit on the couch, and she would sit, like, in a little ball, like a baby. And she called it daddy sitting. I need to do some daddy sitting. And this we did for weeks, maybe months. And just in doing the holding of the baby, kind of like the skin to skin thing, we connected and we created an attachment. And that started leading to me taking on more of a motherly role. And this is where in our family, our roles are kind of reversed. It's I am the nurturer, and Tanya is the provider, structure, pattern, standardizing, logistics person, and kind of support system to me being the nurturer in that case. And of course, as time went on, we started to change our roles a little bit more, and it has evolved. But yeah, I don't know how I got to that point, but it was a very different experience bonding with her and what my role was. I was the nurturer for sure. I would be the one that if she, like with a baby, you have to help them regulate. She needed assistance in self-regulating, so I would put her to bed, you know, I would rub her back or, you know, scratch her head or massage her hands or speak to her or read her something or, you know, rub my belly kind of thing. I would put her to bed. And then in the mornings, I would be the one who was there to help her get up, get ready, get to school kind of thing. It's a very different experience, but at the same time, the same.
It almost sounds like you had an accelerated crash course of like the first like 5 years of a child's life of getting to know and sort of like connect with, you know, your new daughter. And a lot of what you're describing, it sounds like, you know, what this the skin to skin thing, you know, they really hammer that home at, mm-hmm. with, you know, doctors, and we had midwives, we had a doula. They hammered it home, skin to skin. If, you know, if the baby is stressing or if the baby is fussing, like your first option, once you figure out if there isn't anything that's actually harming them, is like, go skin to skin. That's gonna calm them down really quickly. And so the first like couple weeks, 3 weeks, maybe anytime our son was having like a really hard time or really fussing or just not really feeling okay, we'd go into our bathroom, blast the shower so it gets a little bit like damp and humid and warm in there and has a little bit of ambient noise, and just skin to skin, like all three of us like crowded on the toilet seat, sitting, you know, with him cradled between us. And it really does help with that bonding. And it, you know, this whole idea of like this accelerated path to fatherhood, it's almost like the intensity of the experience was crammed into, you know, a relatively short period of time because you had to get caught up to speed.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I mean, we did the whole thing, exactly what you do with a baby. And this is something that I've only been able to learn now having a baby in my life. We did the same thing with a teenager. It's just that we did it. It maybe took 6 months. Within 6 months, we saw her emotional evolution occur. And it was the same care that you give a baby. We were just a little bit later in the picture. But she got it. And that connection, we've gone through so much that I'll have to write a book about this. And of course, I need to get tonight's permission to be able to share these things. But we've gone through so much turmoil. And when I look back at what we've gone through, and being able to see that we're still connected, that we're still a family unit, it just tells me that that bond that occurs, that creates a family unit, that creates a mother, daughter, mother, son, father, daughter relationship, goes beyond biology. It goes beyond our genes. It's something that happens in a proximity with one another that is open to letting go of all expectations, all agendas, and just being. And this is something that became very clear for me where one day Tanai said to me she wanted to have a mentor. And I was like, mentor? You don't need a mentor. I'm your mentor. Right? It's like, what are you talking about? Because I felt like, hey, that's my job. I'm the one that fixes things, you know? And then I realized she doesn't want me to fix nothing for her. She just wants me to be there for her, to simply be a figure that she can come to or she can lean on. And that's it. That's all I had to do. And arriving at that place required me to remove all my little stories and my ego and my my made up needs for her to be or do something in a certain way. And that's very powerful. And that I think that's the essence or the foundation of family.
What was the moment, if there was one, that you realized like, oh, like I actually feel like a dad? Like this is my dad moment.
Mm-hmm. I think it happened actually right away. The moment she came home, it was like bringing your baby home from the hospital where you're just like, this is it. I'm your dad. And that was it. But it started becoming very real. It probably happened 2.5 weeks later. A lot of emotions started to come out and we were actually visiting our in-laws. And she was sleeping upstairs in Tanya's old bedroom, childhood bedroom. And we were downstairs in the guest bedroom. And she came down just like a kid. Hey, I can't sleep. And laid in our bed. And then we thought, well, we have to get you back to your bed, you know, back to your crib kind of thing. I went up there. She wouldn't fall asleep. It was starting to get very emotional. There was a lot of stuff happening. She was processing a lot. And then Tanya came up, and then in the midst of processing a lot of stories, a lot of stuff that had happened in the past, she said, can I ask you guys a question? And we said, sure. And she said, can I call you guys mom and dad? I was like, yeah, of course. And in that moment, it was like sealing the deal. That's the day we kind of signed the papers. So yeah, I felt like a dad from day one, but that day was the day that she made it official. And yeah, very powerful, very just life-changing where you realize, okay, I'm this figure in this person's life now for forever. And what a gift.
Yeah, what a gift indeed. That is a... just the, because there isn't a moment like that. I think, you know, as kids grow up, you kind of just teach them what it is they call you. Mm-hmm. You know, like I call my son Papa all the time. Just like, I just call him Papa. Mm-hmm. And I don't know where that came from. My dad did that with me. My brothers do that with their kids.
We do it with our grandson. We call him Papa too. Hey Papa.
Yeah, it's just like it's part of the thing, right? Mm-hmm. And you kind of teach them, they kind of grow up into understanding those roles. So you know, this scenario that requires like every party in it to very, very quickly adapt and open up to what this new situation means and feels like. What was it like on your wife, right? What was it like on your wife and your relationship through that time?
Absolutely awful. It was,
imagine. Yeah.
Yeah. This was the biggest wedge ever. And I mean, like even crossing my arms here, kind of like freaking out, just remembering this, but you know, Tanai needed a lot of a lot of my attention, and she felt very safe. Like, she wanted to hold my hand. She wanted to hug me. She wanted to cuddle. She wanted to be in between us in the bed. She would even joke, you know, say, baby in the middle, baby in the middle. And we're like, oh, baby in the middle is pretty big right now. That's the day we also decided to get a king bed instead of a queen bed.
It's like, usually baby in the middle doesn't say, I'm going to be baby in the middle.
Right. And she would even make this like voice where she would be like, baby in the middle. You're like, oh my God. She's hilarious, by the way. So there was a lot of funny moments within the chaos, and still we have a lot of funny moments now. But yeah, it was a big wedge in our relationship. And actually it got to the point where I felt like I didn't even know my wife, and I had no clue how to connect with her. And we were definitely not intimate for a long, long time, probably, yeah, close to a year. So yeah, we became two completely separate individuals until we started to experience a lot of hardship coming through tonight, and a few things happened that I just wish I could talk about them, because it would paint a very clear picture, but something that you wouldn't wish upon anybody, okay, happened to her. And when this was happening, we were so thick in that fire that all of a sudden we were able to turn towards each other, and we realized, wait a second, we have to be a team. If we are not a team, we cannot support her, and her history will repeat itself over and over again after this. And that's when we were able to come together, and thankfully, we've been able to stay that way up until now. And it hasn't been easy, but it's been something that we've had to remind each other of. So it took a lot of hardship and a lot of separation. We had to like separate all the way, stretch out all the way, so we could snap back together. And yeah, it was mostly the pain and the struggle to protect our daughter in that moment that led us to, yeah, coming back together and kind of like saying, you and I, we're the team, we're the foundation. Tanai doesn't live in between us, she lives around us.
The mending of your relationship, right? Coming back together, almost like being stronger than you were before. I've learned a lot about my wife. I've learned a lot about our interaction, how to help her, how to support her, how to be supported by her, through almost like the trial by fire that is, you know, having a child. And I'm curious, like, you know, with that occurring, did you guys ever have the conversation of like, oh, like maybe we should have a baby, like maybe we should have a like maybe we should have a little baby too, and then we have Tanai and we have a baby? Like, did that come up?
Tanai wanted us to have a baby. We did not, because after experiencing being her parents, we were so tired. We were so exhausted. We had nothing left in the tank that was the last thing we were thinking about. Plus, I also mentioned that we were not intimate for a very long time. And it's because we just couldn't. I couldn't, especially. I was just, yeah, shut off. In fact, I had a low moment where I drove to the airport. And I just looked up tickets to Spain, to Sweden. And I'm just like, I'm out of here. I'm running away. I'm going to be done. Because I couldn't handle it. And thankfully, I didn't do it. And actually Tanai's therapist came to see me. I called him, and he was able to walk me through the steps. And thankfully, I chose to stay. But moments of weakness are there, and those moments of weakness, although you recover from them, sometimes stick around in ways that don't allow you to even think about, for example, having a baby. We never considered it. But Tanya did bring up, hey, we could be foster parents again. I was like, you say what? but then again, as challenging as it has been, and I'm speaking in this way because I don't want to sugarcoat it, it's probably been the hardest thing I've ever done. It has been the hardest thing I've ever done. I would do it again. If you ask me right now, will you do it again? Will you start right now? I will. There's no doubt in my mind. So could we foster again? Yes. Could we have biological kids? Yes. Which one are we going to choose? Well, I don't know. But I'm not worried about that right now. I'll just let it come as time goes by.
The letting go of that's something that's come up in almost every one of these interviews that I've done. Just the pain and the difficulty and the challenge of letting go of some of these outcomes, because I feel like so many of us like to have control over the process and the end result, and we want it to be a certain way, and because we've built our entire lives around being able to say, I will do this, which will lead to this, which will go here. And there's none of that. Like it's like shooting an arrow into a thunderstorm. There's nothing that you can do to tell you where it's going to go and what's going to happen. It's just as likely to turn around and hit you in the face as it is to keep going anywhere. So the idea of letting go, you know, that it's a challenge to let go of the process and the end result when it comes to dealing with children and your relationship and how you as an input function within that system. It must be equally challenging to let go of like the self, almost like judgment of why aren't I able to handle X, Y, and Z? Why can't I deal with this? Why aren't we on the same page here? And you're not the first person to bring up therapy as a way of dealing with some of that, as a way of kind of addressing some of that. And I wonder, did you have, you know, you sound like you're really, really gung-ho about doing therapy. Did you have like roadblocks to get over, or did you just like immediately were like, this is going to be a lifeline? Like, we're going to hold on to this. And at least for me, this is going to work really, really well.
Well, a little bit of both. I definitely had roadblocks because I had a belief system that I had to work through. And there were many layers that were a part of that belief system that I had to just peel through, and that they take time to ravel through, organize, and then kind of stack wherever you have to stack them, or burn them, or whatever it is that you have to do with your belief systems. But I definitely held on to that lifeline as much as I could. At the same time, I knew that becoming a prisoner of therapy was not the way to go either. And this was something that was coming up for me a lot within my meditation practice. I started really meditating during that time, and I was using it mostly as a band-aid, but I realized that, okay, I can't be dependent on my therapy sessions or on the people around me always feeling good or doing things in a way that I like them done. So where is it that I find solace and comfort and a place where I can be in my power, so to speak, in my sense of control and confidence, and in a place where I can also be of service without causing harm. Because that's one of the biggest things that I learned, that I thought that my service was always good. But many times my way of serving was harmful. Thus, I had to flip the switch. And this was part of the roadblocks that I was meeting, into really hearing what the needs were, and then being able to connect with the feelings that were alive in either Tanai or Tanya or myself, so we could connect. And this is where I had to become a better listener, and I had to let go of trying to bring my strengths to the table, because that's the right thing to do.
Yeah, there's definitely a sense of sometimes, you know, I try and solve a problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, all right, great. I see what the solution is here, and I'm just going to like bowl through a china shop. Doesn't matter. We're going to get to the solution, and then everyone's going to be okay because we got to the solution. And that's not it. That does not get it done. I think I've been learning that, you know, it's become much clearer, obviously, with the baby, because, you know, my wife and I are tired. And, you know, if there's an issue like that, everything gets amplified. Everything becomes much more than it actually is. And so, you know, I remember I was holding my son. He was like maybe 2 weeks old, 3 weeks old. And he was kind of crying a little bit. Not like, it wasn't a serious cry. He was just kind of like fussing and laying out. And I was like crying back at him, not like mocking him, but kind of crying back at him. So I was kind of like, meh, like back at him. Right. And now at like 3 months, that's kind of funny. Like he has this one little cry that I think is really cute and very funny. It doesn't hurt because he's not in desperate need anything, but he does this little like lip pucker and he just goes meh. And it's just the funniest, cutest thing that a little infant has ever done. And at that point, I thought it was funny at like 2 weeks, but my wife did not think it was funny. And it turned into a thing, because my way of sort of dealing with this new responsibility was to kind of, you know, just make light of it a little bit. So I was trying to find the humor in that. And she was like, "You're mocking my baby, and no one mocks my baby." I was like, I'm not making fun of him. Like, this isn't what this, so that's just one. Yeah. When you're tired, everything.
Funny that you say that. Actually, we had the same thing with our grandson, but in reverse. Tanya was mocking him, and I was like, no, do not mess with my baby.
So. Yeah, it is. But it really is. It's wild.
Yeah, it is wild. But yeah, when you are tired, when you haven't slept, and you are confused, and you feel like, oh, wait, I have no time to think, no time to do anything but to focus on this little thing, this little baby that requires all of my attention right now, which, by the way, after 3 months, it gets harder.
I can't wait. I'm so unprepared, but I can't wait.
Everything becomes 10x in magnitude. That's for sure.
So let's talk about your grandson, right? Because you kind of are doing this. You're doing this whole journey a little bit backwards, man. You had a teenager for like 4 or 5 years. So it's 2014. So you had a teenager for 6 years. And then now you have a newborn.
Yeah.
So you basically skipped like, you know, toddler to preteen in the middle there, which I'm sure you're going to experience no problem here. Mm-hmm. Time does travel in one direction quite quickly sometimes. So what's it been like being a granddad? What do you want to be called, by the way? I think this is a really important question. What do you like being called? Do you want to be grandpa, granddad?
I call myself Morfar, which is mother's father in Swedish. And okay. that's how you say grandpa on your from your father's side. Yeah,
I love it. In Armenia, there's similar things where aunts and uncles have different titles based off of which side of the family they're from. So yeah, that totally makes sense.
Yeah. So I'm mother's father to him, his mother's father. that's a Mufar. And I tell him every day, Mufa, 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 I'm Mufa. Mufasa. I'm Mufasa. It's been amazing. The day he was born, which was at 11:59 p.m. on February 9th, I got a FaceTime call right away. Tanya was in the delivery room with Tanai, and I saw his face, and I was just in awe. I just fell in love immediately. And then he got out of the hospital 2 days later, and I held him. He was just like a little peanut. There's actually a picture of me holding him on Instagram in my car. I was like, oh my goodness, what is this? It was amazing because when I looked at him, I saw Tanai's eyes. I saw Tanai's mouth. And I was like, whoa, this is Tanai as a baby. And here I am holding her and him at the same time. Absolutely incredible. And of course, I had all these flashbacks from Tanai coming into our life and how that happened, and realizing, wow, this is the missing link. This is the thing that we were missing. And now we're getting to experience it in this form. And yeah, that's kind of how I've been taking it. And what I've had to consciously do is decouple them as two individuals, of course. But it's inevitable to experience our daughter through him. And that's been the best part. And then our family dynamics is complicated, but he spends a lot of time with us. She's 23. She's out doing everything she can to be the best mother that she can. And at the age of 23, well, you have a lot of things that you're working on. So we spend a lot of time with him, and he spends nights with us very often. So we've experienced the whole gamut of what it's like to have a baby around. And the first time he actually spent time with us, I remember kind of holding him or having him for the first time for an extended period of time. And I remember within 5 minutes, I was like, wait, is this normal? So I went in to tell Tanya, I was like, is this normal? And she was finally sleeping. And she's like, get the hell out of here. Figure it out. You know, like, you do the thing. And I was like, oh, I think he has hiccups. I don't know how to do it. I don't know how to, nothing, right? But slowly we've evolved. And I even had him on my own, just me with the baby, for 11 days once. And that was
11 days.
Yeah. He was 5 months old.
I thought you were going to say like 11 hours. I was going to be like, man,
no,
like nicely done.
11 days.
That's wild. That's almost 2 weeks, Carl.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was crazy. I was like, this is the hardest thing I've ever done. I think I lost like 8 pounds. I didn't eat. I didn't sleep. It was just pure like racing to figure this out, but managed to get through it. And I have an amazing bond with him, and we are best buds, and we have a lot of fun, and we have our little things that we do together. And he wakes up in the morning and he's just like big smile. He's very much like his mother. And he talks a lot. He has a lot to say. We have full-on conversations, philosophical ones about, you know, the status of the world and all kinds of things. So he's just amazing. And every day, you know, every day he's just changing. I mean, eating new foods, tasting new things, seeing new things, interacting with our, he loves our dog, Callie. He thinks it's hilarious. So he sees the dog and he cracks up. And then he sees, you know, I put Elmo on for him on YouTube sometimes, which I need to be careful with because we're starting to get kind of addicted to the YouTube thing. He's like 8 months old, already has his iPad. I'm like, oh no, everything I said I wasn't going to do, here I am doing it. But yeah, we're watching Elmo, and all of a sudden, like, Schmoodle, the dog comes out, and he's like, oh my God, Schmoodle. It's like the best thing ever, you know? So it's a great, great experience. And I'm just so grateful I get to be his grandpa, and just a friend and a person that is going to be next to him for as long as I live and he's around. And yeah, it's just the best gift ever, ever. And no matter how tired I am, like when I'm exhausted and he leaves, I'm like, what am I going to do with my life now? I have no purpose, no identity. I have nothing. And I have to like refine myself every time. But the respite is, I think, is a gift.
That's really beautiful, Carl. I have one last thing I wanted to touch on, because you had mentioned this, and I think it's an interesting and a really important topic to talk about, which is the fact that, you know, your daughter Tanai is Black, your son, your grandson is Black. You and Tanya are not Black. You guys are white. And you know, we live in a, I don't know, we live in a time and a place where there's a lot around that, you know, those things, there's a lot that comes with that. And I'm curious what that experience was like for you guys to sort of come face to face almost with, you know, Tanai's experiences, her life, you know, her, you know, worldview and your worldview kind of clashing, and what the process was for, you know, sort of wrapping your brain around that.
Yeah. Holy moly. Very challenging. A lot of introspection that has been extremely painful, and painful because you have to assume new levels of responsibility, and what you thought was isn't, and you start to really learn about what is now kind of spoken of as white privilege, and realizing that this is real, it's a thing, and that no matter how much one says, oh, I'm not racist, or I don't see color, it's not about what you think, it's about what you're subconscious holds. And this is not something that happens overnight, and as we've heard many times, it's systemic, and it's cultural, and it's inevitable to miss a few things when you are a white male especially. And I'm so grateful I got to see this, experience this up close, and especially through Tanai, because Tanai had the ability to, in her own way of being gentle, but gently guiding me where I needed to go in order to take the responsibility that I needed to take as a white parent to a Black kid, without feeling shame, but rather feeling empowered. And I remember the day that we went to a family reunion of her biological family. And here we are, the two white young couple showing up in Oakland at a park with a fully Black family, of course. And being the new foster parents to their teenage family member, and having to not only be faced with being the new caregivers of this child, but also having that cultural clash where, you know, they're thinking something of you and you are thinking something of them. And then also having the awareness of exactly what is being thought of there, and being able to let go of that and take that pressure, that expectation away. That being very challenging. But thankfully, we were able to work through it. It hasn't been easy, but it's in the works every day. And there have been a few occasions where I know I've broken through certain walls and barriers finally, where I've finally been able to, through my taking of responsibility of who I am in this situation, and them seeing consistency over the last 8 years and being like, can I swear here?
Yeah, of course.
Them seeing me and being like, you crazy motherfucker, you're still around. We can't fucking believe this shit. This is insane. I'm like, yes, I did it. And being kind of welcomed a little bit more. And now with the birth of our grandson, being welcomed a little bit more every single day. And I mean, there are a lot of details that, once again, I wish I could disclose, but I can't, because I don't want to invade anyone's privacy. And there's a lot of stuff that is still in the works and happening. But I'm also very aware of how I or Tanya can be perceived. And it brings a lot of tension. And I think right now the tension can only be softened by saying, show me, teach me, guide me. I don't get it. I don't understand it. I probably never will, but I'm not going anywhere.
That's really beautiful. I mean, I think that's an attitude that helps helps kind of bring down some potentially like confrontational walls, at the very least opening up conversation, at the very least showing positive intent, you know, putting yourself in a position to be like, listen, I don't know what I don't know. If you even give me 0.1% of a little bit of insight here, it's going to give me a foothold to move forward. And I think that's a really powerful place to be at, and that I think that's a good lesson for a lot of people to kind of take. Carl, this has been awesome. I mean, this has been really, really cool. You have such an interesting and exciting and powerful, you know, story here about, you know, becoming a dad and fostering and adopting and then becoming a grandfather. It's really, really cool. And I cannot thank you enough for sharing the story with me.
I really appreciate you taking the time to have me here and letting me share. And for the listener, you know, if I was vague, it's simply because it's out of respect for all parties. And like anything in life, it's complex. And learning to be transparent where it is of service is a skill set that I'm still learning. But I think through parenthood and now through being a grandfather, I'm learning that every day. And something that somebody told me not too long ago that I think is very powerful was that you only learn to become somebody's son or daughter when you become a parent. You only become or learn how to become a parent, when you become a grandparent. And learning is really just understanding, and understanding is simply knowledge in context. And as long as we are contextualizing every single moment, that is us trying to understand, or at least being open to understand. And I think that's what parenthood is really all about.
Yeah, I think some people might hear that and think, man, you're always just going to be behind the eight ball. You're like, you're never going to be caught up. But I think there's a certain freedom in that, you know,
Yeah. 100%. And I think this is the art of letting go. It's kind of like, okay, you're trying your best and your best is the best. That's it. But just know that things will make sense in retrospect. So be surprised, be excited when you're there, and you'll be like, ah, now it makes sense. And realize that the record of the past and your perception and your understanding of it, that's the gift. That's the gift. And here we are passing that gift on to the future generations.
That's beautiful, Carl. Thank you, man.
Yeah, thank you.